Today is Wednesday, July 16th, 2025. And brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Mark O'Grady. The theme for Brother O'Grady's classes this week is Caleb, Giant of Faith. Today's class is entitled, My Servant Caleb Had Another Spirit. Brother Mark.
Well, thank you, Brother Ralph, and good morning, brothers and sisters. You know, Caleb was a man who wore his convictions on his sleeve. We ended our last study with Caleb absolutely appalled at the negative feedback from his 10 colleagues, and then aghast at its impact on the people as this tide of discontent spread out amongst the crowd. And in the face of a rising tide of audible emotion, Caleb leaps into the breach, and we're told in Numbers 13 verse 30 that he stilled or hushed the people, saying, let's go up at once and possess it. We're able to overcome. And we saw that Caleb had hoped to stop the rot in its tracks, to overthrow the negative influences of those other spies, and to encourage the people to take on God's promises. But he was thwarted. And his hopes were cruelly dashed as those 10 men doubled down. We cannot take the land. The people are too strong. We cannot overcome. But if that was not bad enough, worse, much worse, was to follow. These evil men pressed home their advantage. And if you turn with me to Numbers 13 and verse 32, we read of the awful third phase of their destructive work. But the record says in verse 32, they brought up an evil report of the land. The phrase evil report, it's the Hebrew word debar, and it means a defamation, a whispering, or a slander. It comes from a root, it's quite expressive, dabab, which means to move gently, to glide over. The word conveys the idea of furtive motion. So the theological word book says this word refers to defamation, perhaps whispered slander, if the connection is with this root, debab, to move gently. The word's used three times in the record to make the point. It also comes up in chapter 14, verse 36, bringing up a slander upon the land, and again in verse 37, the evil report upon the land. Now, the inference of this word is that having publicly opposed Caleb, we are not able, the people are too strong, not content with that, they now start to spread their poison in private. Insidious poison, behind closed doors, as it were, over a cup of coffee. You know, the most awful things are often said in private, aren't they? Away from public gaze and scrutiny. Away from public gaze, it's much easier for each of us to say bad things, dishonest things, slanted, twisted, slightly exaggerated things, just a slight changing of the truth to justify ourselves, perhaps to make other people look worse. You know, it's just one of those horrible tendencies of the flesh. And none of us are actually immune from it. We need to be so careful to keep a guard on how we speak in private. And so now they use exaggeration, irrational language, in a deliberate attempt to sway emotions. You know, phrases like, the city's walls reach up to heaven, or, all the people are of great stature, or, we felt like grasshoppers, or, this land eats up the inhabitants thereof. And their words had the desired effect. Numbers 14, verse 1, all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. Deuteronomy 1, verse 27 says, and you murmured in your tents. So start to picture this. This is now happening back in their own tents. This is happening around their campfires. So let's start trying to put the passages together and picture what's happening now. Because, of course, there'd been this first public gathering of the congregation to the tabernacle before Moses and Aaron with all the congregation when the spies gave their first unfaithful initial report. Then the indication of this phrase is that a whispering campaign, slander, got underway in private. So think about it. They're all there together, and then they disperse. The congregation goes back that night to their own camps, their own tribal areas. Excuse me. So where do you think the 12 spies went? Well, they would have gone home too, to their own tents. And remember, these are representative men. One man from each tribe. So they all head back to the various tribal areas of the camp. And as they return, each to their own personal tribal location, can you imagine the people in their tribe gathering around their man to get the real story about what's actually gone on? And that's most likely where the evil slander was spread. Can you imagine them gathered around the campfires that night? Oh, you've got no idea how big those walls are. And the height of all those people, you know, as we walk through the land, oh, that land eats up. Can you hear the private slander going on in those individual people? This is an unhealthy infection of faithlessness. And it's working its evil work throughout the camp. And so the record says the congregation lifted up their voice and cry. The people are weeping that night. It's out loud. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and his faithful friend Joshua heard the wailing of the people around them that night. It would have broken their heart. Caleb never forgot that moment. It was burned in his memory. 45 years later, he laments, "My brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt." That's recorded in Joshua 14 and verse 8. You imagine how Caleb felt as he heard this tsunami of discontent just wash over the camp. And despite their own outstanding faithfulness, Caleb and Joshua were powerless to stop this. Just think about this. Caleb was a head and prince of the tribe of Judah. But not one other person of his generation, even in his own adopted tribe of Judah, was saved to go through ultimately into the promised land. Even his own adopted tribe was carried away with this dissimulation. But when we think about the reality of the record, we find that it bites even deeper than that, his own family. Later in scripture, we read of Othniel, the first judge of Israel. He's introduced to us in the record, Judges 1 verse 13, as Othniel, the son of Kenaz, who was Caleb's younger brother. Kenaz, assuming he's of the same generation as Caleb, Kenaz, Caleb's own younger brother, never made it into the land. He, too, was part of a generation whose bodies were wasted in the wilderness. Now, the next day, this erupts into full-blown open public rebellion because the people, after wailing all night, they leave their tents and they start to congregate again around the tabernacle against Moses and Aaron. And can you just see this welter of discontentment as they start to gather in anger? It's a very unedifying sight. Very disturbing as in your mind you picture this rabble seething in blame and bitterness, and they start to gather around the door of the tabernacle to attack Moses and Aaron. And we're going to experience those events as we stand alongside them in front of the tabernacle on that fateful day. Now, it's useful here to splice in the details of the record in Deuteronomy chapter 1, because as we put that together with Numbers 14, we get a complete picture of what actually took place. And it appears the flow of the narrative goes something like this. The people arrive and they complain against Moses. Moses tries to reassure the people of God's love. It's a beautiful record there in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 29 to 31. It's actually a beautiful expression by Moses of his confidence in God's love for the people. It's not recorded in Numbers 14. It is in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Then the people appoint themselves a new captain. Joshua and Caleb appeal to the people, and then the people try to stone them. So this is quite a progression that takes place. So let's stand there alongside Caleb now, as he's there with Moses and Aaron and Joshua facing off against this crowd. Now read very carefully what the people say in verse 2 and 3. Note the specific phrases, because these phrases become the base or the foundation of God's judgments later in the chapter. All the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt! Or would God we had died in this wilderness! And wherefore hath Yahweh brought us unto this land, to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return to Egypt?" So in particular, would God we had died in the land of Egypt, or died in this wilderness? Yahweh brought us into this land to fall by the sword. Our wives and our children are going to be a prey, and it would be better to return to Egypt. Now, the full ugliness of their words is actually conveyed in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 27. And just listen to these words. "Because Yahweh hated us, he brought us forth out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us." Can you imagine Caleb hearing those ghastly words? His family had given up everything to join themselves to Israel and the hope of Israel. For generations, they'd held on to the faithful promises to Abraham with a steadfast conviction that what God had promised, he would fulfill. Caleb had seen Yahweh's power as he saw the plagues roll across the land of Egypt. He had marched with them in amazement through the Red Sea with the towering walls of water. He had marveled at God's goodness in the provision of manna in the wilderness. And he'd encouraged the people the previous night to go up and possess the land, because with God on their side, they would be able. And here are his adopted family, and they're accusing their God of hating them and deliberately bringing them out to destroy them. Can you imagine the distress those words would have caused Caleb as he heard them from his adopted family, and everything that he believed in was being slandered, abused, and trashed? But at this point, it's fitting that it was the old man Moses who actually responds to the people. And when they accused their God of hating them and wanting to destroy them, it was more than Moses could bear. He had seen Yahweh's love. He had seen and experienced Yahweh's mercy towards his people. He had heard Yahweh's declaration of his character in his name: merciful, gracious, long-suffering, abundant in goodness, in truth. And it just grieved him at his heart, of all things, to accuse God of hating them with everything that Moses had seen God would do. So that's the matter which Moses picks up in his response, as recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 1. "Dread not, neither be afraid of them." You see what he's doing first? He's tackling the underlying issue. They're scared. There's a lack of faith. They're frightened. "Yahweh, your God, which goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where thou hast seen, so that yet how Yahweh thy God bear thee, as a man doth bear his son, in all the way that ye went until ye came to this place." You notice he's saying, "your eyewitnesses. This was done before your eyes. You have seen what Yahweh did." And he reassures them, "Yahweh your God goeth before you." Now, I'd like to just start us to think about what the implications of these words are. This is the message of Numbers 10 verse 33. Remember the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. And it says in the record that it went before them in the journey, 3 days' journey, to search out a resting place for them. Now, we know that Israel went through tough times. You imagine having no food for your family. Imagine a day when you had no water and your children and you were thirsty. There were days when the enemies attacked them. Life was not easy in the wilderness. But nevertheless, God was leading them through it. And each time the ark moved, he was searching out a resting place for them along the journey. Now, brothers and sisters, our journey to the kingdom is likened to the wilderness wanderings of Israel. There are many twists and turns to our own personal journey as well. Sometimes it feels like we are in a waste, howling wilderness as well. But understand that God's objective is always to bring us, in the end, through to the promised land. Moses said to them that Yahweh goes before you. Have you ever thought about that in relation to your personal life? Just think about our life, all its ups and downs, all its challenges, and think of God going in the journey a few days in front of us to search out resting places for us. What that tells us, brothers and sisters, is that God is involved in our personal journey towards the kingdom. And despite all the ups and downs, the challenges which we face, sometimes seemingly insurmountable challenges, along the journey, God provides resting places for us. Things which are able to sustain us despite the trials. Places where we can take support or comfort from our brothers and sisters or from things that God's done to help us in life along that journey. And if in the eye of faith we can see that our God is actually walking in the journey ahead of us to provide resting places, it helps us maintain our faith through that journey. Do we think of our God like that? Then he says in verse 30 that Yahweh would fight for them. You know, they've already seen that. The word fight there, lacham. God's actually going out and fighting for them earlier in their journey. When they were standing, trembling in fear, with the Egyptians coming upon them, mountains either side, facing the Red Sea, not sure what they were going to do, Moses says, Exodus 14, verse 4, fear ye not. Stand still and see the salvation of Yahweh, which he will show you this day. Yahweh shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. So how does God go before us to fight our battles? Because he actually does do that. He does it providentially. We don't see it in the same way. But God is actually going before us, fighting our battles for us in the journey. It actually means that he will help us to overcome and hold on to our faithfulness in the journey towards the kingdom. And then he talks about God carrying them as a father bear his son. So when the people have actually accused God of hating them, Moses creates a visual picture for them with words. He says, I want you to picture God as a young man carrying his own child through the wilderness. That's the imagery that God is using. Isaiah 46, verse 3 and 4. Hearken to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb. It's the same word, carried. And even to your old age I am he. Even to hoar heads will I carry you. I have made, and I will bear. It's the same word. Even I will carry and will deliver you. You know, brothers and sisters, our God's the same God. He will pick us up and carry us through the path to the kingdom age. So when we face trials in life, hold on to that image of a man picking up his little child and carrying his child through the wilderness. That's the love that Moses wanted the people to appreciate. So what's their response? Numbers 14, verse 4, they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return to Egypt. You notice they don't even say it to Moses? The record says they said it to one another. It's like they just despise him and his words. They turn their back on him. Ah, silly old fool, don't listen to him. We might as well get ourselves a captain and go back to Egypt. It's just awful. It's ghastly, brothers and sisters. It's the shocking response of hard-hearted people who are now revealing what's actually going on inside their heart. You know, faithlessness for us is not going through trials. Faithlessness is not grappling with doubts or fears. Faithlessness is when God provides things or people to support us and we reject that and despise that and despise our God. Sometimes it gets to a point when someone doesn't want to do what's right that it's actually impossible for us to reason them through it. This is what happens when someone's been committed to a way of life for a period, and then when trials and pressures come on, they turn back to the natural man. This is what happens when someone says, you know, I gave up a lot for the truth, and now I regret the things which I actually lost. You can no longer reason with a person if their mind is made up. So brothers and sisters, when we set out on a journey towards the promised land, grasp hold of that journey with both hands and never let it go. Stay the course, despite the trials and the upsets that come along the journey. Either God's right with what he's promised, or he's not. And when we come under pressure, pulling back, and reverting back to what we have left, or to the world, or to the natural man, will only end in disaster. Stay the course. That's the words of the apostle in Hebrews 10, verse 37. For yet a little while, he that shall come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. But we are not of them who draw back unto perdition, but them who believe to the saving of the soul. And later, in the next chapter, in Hebrews 11, the apostle goes on to speak of those who didn't look back at what they'd left behind, but who looked for a city to come. And the apostle says, in verse 15 of Hebrews 11, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. Now, those words were spoken of the patriarchs, but aren't they applicable for our incident here in Numbers chapter 13? But you know, the terrible thing is, in Numbers 14, it suggests that they talked about making a captain. You know, they went further than that. They actually did appoint themselves a leader, a captain, to take them back to Egypt. We know that because in Nehemiah 9 verse 17 it says they refused to obey, neither were mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks, and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. It's astounding. It's appalling. After Moses' plea, they actually appointed themselves a new leader. So what we have going on here is open rebellion. It's a coup. They have rejected the leadership of Moses and Aaron and appointed themselves a new leader. So at this point, Moses and Aaron do the only thing they can do. They just fall flat on their face in front of the congregation before their God. No reaction of offense or wounded pride or anger. They just fall flat on their face before God. Truly, Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. They were also terrified of what they thought the consequences might be from God when he heard those terrible words. You know, it happens like that in life sometimes, doesn't it? When someone is hardened in heart and they're blaming other people and bitter towards God, justifying themselves in a particular course, you realize you can no longer reason with them. At that stage, all we can do, brothers and sisters, is fall on our face before God and plead for his mercy for them. But there's two other men standing there on that fateful day watching all this unfold. These two men are a generation younger. They're distressed at the blindness of these people who can't see, and they're deeply incensed at the way Moses and Aaron have been treated. And they are so upset, they can't hold back. And so we pick up the record in Numbers 14 with Joshua and Caleb. It's interesting, as you go through the record, it's normally Caleb who's at the forefront all through this record. He's probably the older man. He's the one who's commended by Yahweh. It's his spirit that shines forth. But here, at this point, it's actually Joshua who's mentioned first. And I suspect we know why. Joshua's introduced to us in the record as being a young man who was the servant of Moses, one of his young men, Numbers 11, verse 28. And you may remember the incident of Eldad and Medad. And when Joshua reacted, Moses said to him, "Joshua, enviest thou for my sake?" So here's a young man who's loyal. He's passionately dedicated to helping his master, Moses. It's no wonder at this point, when they reject Moses, that Joshua comes to the fore. But make no mistake, brothers and sisters, these two men operate as one. And I'd like you to see, this is Caleb and Joshua together. In verse 6, we've got Joshua the son of Nun, Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes, and they spake unto all the company of the children of Israel. Notice something strange about that. You've got two men, but it records them with one set of words. It's as if they're speaking as one. They're absolutely united in their response. So what I want us to do now is spend a few moments looking at the response and see what it tells us about Caleb's own spirit now as they try to turn the tide of the people. In verse 6, it says, "Joshua and Caleb, which were of them that searched the land." Didn't we already know that? The record's already told us that. What's the point that it's making? It's telling us that they have stood aside from their erstwhile colleagues. They have had the courage to stand aside against what's happening. Truly, Caleb has another spirit. They then rent their clothes, the record tells us. One commentator I read suggested that tearing clothes is an expression of fear, horror, consternation, or dismay over a calamity that has directly or indirectly affected the person performing the action or threatens to do so. Ripping their clothes is a very visible demonstration of their distress. Now, let's have a look at what they go on to say. The first thing they do in verse 7 is they stand up for the integrity of God's land. The land which we passed through to search it is an exceeding good land. And they're quoting here God's words of Exodus 3 verse 8 when he said, "I'll bring them out of their land unto a good land." He's saying, this is just what God promised. He promised he would do it. I've been there. I've seen it. It's a good land, just as God promised. Then they say in verse 8, "If Yahweh delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which flows with milk and honey." You know, there's no question in their mind that God can give it to them. But did you notice that he's introduced here a condition? If Yahweh delight in us. You know, God's mercy and his goodness is unending, but it's not unconditional. And they've introduced this condition here because of what they're actually seeing. And they're telling the people that if Yahweh delights in them, then he will give them that land. And now in verse 9, they address the people directly with a frank rebuke. Only rebel not against Yahweh. Because it's changed, brothers and sisters. It's no longer just doubt. Now it's open-faced rebellion against the things of God. And then they say in verse 9, "Fear ye not the people of the land." And again, they address the underlying root cause of the issue, which is the people's fear of the people of the land. When we become frightened, fear is such a debilitating thing, isn't it? It saps strength. And they reassure the people with this intriguing little comment. It's a lovely expression, or a very colourful expression. They say the people are bread for us, lehem. Their defence is departed from them because Yahweh is with us. Now think about the implications of those words. their defense is departed from them. Just imagine if we could approach our battles in life with that confidence. As we look at the terrible things we may face, to say, actually, their defense is departed from them. It has the idea of God undermining and weakening and removing their defense before the battle actually begins. There's a wonderful passage, we won't turn it up, but in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, the apostle talks about our battle, and he says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty to God through the pulling down of strongholds." Now, in our journey, brothers and sisters, where's the biggest foe? What's the biggest enemy that we face? It's our minds. It's what goes on inside and how we think. That's the greatest foe that we face. Do you know what the apostle says in the next verses in 1 Corinthians 10? "These mighty weapons, strong through God to the pulling down of strongholds, cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and brings into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." Isn't that what we want, brothers and sisters? Bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. That's the enemy we face, brothers and sisters. "And the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're mighty to God through the pulling down of strongholds. And it's in our hearts and minds. That's where the power of the truth gives us the strength to overcome in that battle. And so Caleb says, "Your troubles?" He said, "They're like a piece of bread." Now, isn't that graphic? Just a little morsel of bread. You know, you can just gobble it up and it's gone. Have you ever been able to face your trials in life looking at it that way? That's the power of an extraordinary faith. So they plead with the people, they rebuke them, they reassure them that God is able to bring them through into the land, even at this late stage of the rebellion. How do the people now respond? They bade stone them with stones. After those heartfelt pleas by these distressed brethren, with ripped garments, pleading with them not to rebel against God, stone them. And nothing more could be done now with these intractable people. The record simply says, "And the glory of Yahweh appeared in the tabernacle before all the children of Israel." So I'd like you to picture the scene, brothers and sisters, in your mind. You gathered there with all the children of Israel, the congregation, before the tabernacle. You've seen this terrible rebellion against Moses. You've seen the people vent their hatred against Caleb and Joshua. And suddenly, the scene is dominated by this exceedingly powerful, radiant, terrifying glory that's shining through the very fabric of the tabernacle itself. The glory of Yahweh was seen in the tabernacle. Burning, brilliant radiance. And the voice of God is heard out loud. "I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them." Now, it's not our story for today, but it's worth, in your own leisure, reading through what Moses now says at this point in time. It's nothing short of extraordinary. The entire fate of the nation now is hanging in the balance. And Moses, the meekest man on all the earth, having been rejected by his own people, stands in the breach and pleads for Yahweh to spare them. He pleads actually on the basis of Yahweh's name and his reputation that he not destroy the people. He asks for the power of Yahweh to be great in forgiveness, and he quotes back at God, God's own words from Sinai. Verses 18 and 19, "Now I beseech thee, let the power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken, saying, Yahweh is long-suffering and of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression. by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people, and according to the greatness of thy mercy, as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even till now. It's an extraordinary intercession by a man who's been so badly treated by his brethren. And Yahweh's response then, in Numbers 14, contains some of the best known words of Scripture, as far as we're concerned as Christadelphians. Truly I live, says Yahweh. And he swears this extraordinary oath, and he's calling upon his very existence as the guarantee of what he's about to say. So what is the oath that he swears? Now, we as Christadelphians, we look at verse 20 and 21, and we quote it often. We quote it in our baptismal interviews. We quote it in our public lectures as being a statement of God's purpose with the earth. I have pardoned according to thy word, verse 21, but as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of Yahweh. And we stop there. And we say, oh, that's God's purpose with the earth. Now, that's not wrong, brothers and sisters, in a sense. But it's not actually the point that God is making here in this great oath that he swears. The point of this oath is terrifying. It's a promise that those men will not inherit the kingdom. Look at the flow of the narrative. Later, verse 28, truly I live, he repeats the message, so will I do to you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Verse 35, I, Yahweh, have said, I will surely do it unto all this evil congregation. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. Later, when Moses refers to it, Numbers 32, verse 10, Yahweh's anger was kindled the same time, and he swears, saying, surely none of the men that came up from Egypt shall see the land. Deuteronomy 1, verse 34, Yahweh heard the voice of your words and was wroth, and swear, saying, surely there shall not one of these men of this evil generation see the land. That's the main focus of the terrible oath that Yahweh swears in Numbers 14. And then he goes on to play back their own words to them in this judgment that he pronounces. Just have a look at the words of verse 28 to 31. Truly I live, as you have spoken in mine ears, so will I do to you. Your carcasses will fall in this wilderness, all that were numbered of you according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me. Doubtless you shall not come into the land concerning which I swear to make you dwell there, save Caleb and Joshua. But your little ones, which you said would be a prey, them will I bring in, and they shall know the land which you've despised. And he plays back their own words. Would to God we died in the wilderness. As you've spoken, you will die in the wilderness. Our children are going to be a prey. Your little ones will I bring in. Yahweh's brought us out here to fall by the sword. Ye shall fall by the sword, because you have turned away from Yahweh. It's an irony, isn't it? So often our own spirit becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of our destiny. And then he says, and your little ones will know the land that you have despised. And then he goes back to Caleb. He has another spirit. He's followed me fully. He will inherit the land. Now, brothers and sisters, at this stage in our journey, I'd like us to join very close beside Caleb. Stand there right beside him through this process. You can imagine how Caleb felt as he heard Yahweh's anger expressed to the people. Like a thunderclap, he would have heard those terrible words. This entire generation, from 20 years old and upward, would be wasted in the wilderness. What a tragedy. What an extraordinary waste. Verse 33, and your children will wander in the wilderness for 40 years. They will bear your whoredoms for 40 years. So not only is a whole generation going to die, but the next generation is going to have to struggle and suffer and bear the consequence of their parents' faithlessness until their parents have been destroyed. And then, as Caleb's standing there, he suddenly sees, as Yahweh's great anger is turned onto the people who are most responsible. Remember, we've got 10 faithless spies still standing there amongst this congregation in front of the tabernacle. So in your mind, I'd like you to picture them standing there. Moses and Aaron, Caleb and Joshua, the 10 faithless spies, the rabble of the congregation, the new leaders that they have appointed. And as you look at all these people around you, suddenly before your horrified gaze, Shemua, the son of Zachur of the tribe of Reuben, he cries out and he clutches at his chest and he falls to his knees and he rolls over in the dust and he expires. And suddenly there's another cry as Shaphat, the son of Hori of the tribe of Simeon, he's struck down by plague and he dies. Then Amiel, quickly followed by Setha, by Nabi, and then in a final moment of agony, Gul, the son of Malchi. They all cry out in pain and double over and die. Imagine how dramatic and terrifying it would be as one by one, those 10 men, all heads of the congregation, are struck down. Verse 37, even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by the plague before Yahweh. Can you imagine the consternation of the congregation with their heads turning first this way and that way as they watched these 10 faithless men all struck down by the plague and dying there on the ground before the tabernacle of the congregation? And finally, as the cries of those men fade away, it's obvious there's only 2 men left standing of the original 12. Verse 38, but Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of the men that went to search the land, lived still. Can you imagine how horrified Caleb would have been? As these colleagues, who he later described as my brethren that went up with me, who he traveled with for 40 days, he'd shared meals together with them, suffered deprivation and risk and danger together, carried the fruits of the land back together, as his colleagues are consigned to immediate death. They all watched them die before Yahweh in a moment. Imagine being Caleb, standing there, looking around, and realizing you're one of only 2 that are left alive. You'd feel very vulnerable, wouldn't you? You'd feel very small. Sometimes I wonder, brothers and sisters, if perhaps the reality of the presence of our mighty God is something which we need to respect more in our daily life. But then as the dust settles, the awful reality of what God's decreed begins to sink in. You imagine Caleb just trying to mentally process what he's just experienced, what's just happened. He's just seen the 10 spies struck down. He's heard the judgment of Yahweh on the rest of the nation, and slowly, the crushing, overwhelming realization of what this means would dawn on him. Caleb's just walked through the promised land. Caleb has just carried the fruits of the promised land back. He's seen how beautiful that land is. He's seen that all the fruitfulness is sitting there waiting for them to be able to pick it. He knew without hesitation that God is able to give him that land and his personal inheritance, despite his own faithfulness, is taken away from him for another 38 years. It wasn't just the children who were condemned to wander in the wilderness for another 38 years. Think about the implication of those words for Caleb himself. What a bitter pill. It's a tragic dashing of his own hopes. His own destiny, it's inextricably bound with the consequences of those faithless men. It's sad at times, isn't it, to observe in ecclesial life how wicked behavior in ecclesial life creates victims, innocent victims, who suffer the consequences of other people's sins. He too had to bear the iniquity of those people for another 38 long, weary years. Can you imagine how he would have felt as he retired, stunned to his tent that night? A broken-hearted, crushed man. With these words of God ringing in his ears, after the number of the days in which he searched the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, shall ye bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and you shall know my breach of promise. So rather than rejoicing in his new inheritance at age 40, he didn't get to enjoy it until he was 85. Nearly half a century of his own personal enjoyment of the promised land was snatched away from him really cruelly. And it was just within his grasp. He'd stood on the land. He'd smelt the land. He'd eaten its fruit. And it was taken away. You have to feel for that man. And here, brothers and sisters, is the most extraordinary thing. Do you read any words of complaint? Any recriminations against his brethren? Any bitterness of spirit? Any bemoaning of his faith? Any questioning of the rightness of God's judgment? Or does he throw in the towel and separate himself from those faithless men and go it alone? There's simply a wholehearted, accepting trust of the Father's will. And faithfully, that man trudges through the wilderness for another 38 years, and when they finally enter the land, there he is, faithful, resolute, committed, just as he had been, unchanged, a faith that didn't waver for another 40 years. I find that truly remarkable. What a measure of the faith of that man. Truly, this man had another spirit. So, brothers and sisters, what's the secret? What will give us the faith to endure the most awful of setbacks in life? How do we survive the most unexpected of crushing blows? How do we cope with the greatest of disappointments, followed sometimes by the interminable grind of 38 more years of trudging through the wilderness, and still come out resolute with an unchanged faith? Well, in the hour of his extremity, in the hour of his greatest need, Caleb was given a reassurance, and that enabled him to overcome everything that this life could throw at him. He was given something to cling on to, something which would help him to rise above and overcome the trials of this life. Yahweh gave him a personal guarantee that he would enter that land. And the final phase of Yahweh's oath is recorded in verse 24. It's part of Yahweh's oath. But my servant Caleb will I bring into the land, and his seed shall possess it. Now, in conclusion, brothers and sisters, I'd like you to come over with me to Hebrews chapter 3. You know, the following day, the Israelites had a change of heart. They woke up the next day, and they suddenly said, "Oh, whoops, look what we've lost." And they say, and it's pathetic to look at, "Oh, here we are," they said, "we'll go up today. We'll go up now, and we'll take the promised land." You know, 24 hours earlier, that would have been a good idea. It's now one awful day too late. What a difference one day makes. On that one day, the entire generation, apart from two men, lost their entry to the promised land. Now, as you would expect, this extraordinary event becomes one of the main events of the wilderness wanderings, which is picked up and referred to in multiple places in the New Testament. An example of it here is in Hebrews chapter 3, as the apostle quotes many times, actually, from Psalm 95. Pick up the record in verse 7. "Wherefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. Your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my works 40 years. I was grieved with that generation." Verse 11, "So I swear in my wrath," here's his oath, "they will not enter into my rest." And then, brothers and sisters, the voice of God speaks directly to us. Verse 13, "Exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." Brothers and sisters, today is our day of opportunity. At some point shortly, that day will end. So let's hear his voice and believe in our heart that he is able.